The boundaries have been broken.
Welcome to Vanguard Radio.
I believe that your primitive cerebrum kept trying to wake up. Deep in the belly of the Quah. This is Jeff Beck. I'm your host for
The Truth Is No Defense.
We can't live in a world where these blacks, rapists, murderers, criminals are allowed to run wild. We live in a world where these police need to shut these Negroes down. There's no one willing to do this in this country today, except for the National
That was Bill White, spokesman for the NSM, speaking at an April 22nd NSM rally in Lansing, Michigan. And tonight, Bill White is our special guest on this Truth Is No Defense broadcast. Welcome, Bill White.
Oh, and thank you for having me, Jeff Beck. It's a pleasure to be able to bring the message of the National Socialist Movement onto Vanguard News Network.
Well, for many, including myself, events in Lansing and earlier in Toledo, Ohio, were our first introductions to the NSM. These two events, they electrified the VNN forum. And so I know that many on VNN are curious about the NSM, and it's generated a lot of controversy, so I'm really pleased to have you on the show.
Thank you, Jeff. The National Socialist Movement has been around since 1974. But it has always been controversial and always been drawing a lot of attention, particularly the last few years, as the other players in this scene have sort of dissolved and melted away. And it's a pleasure to be able to bring, again, our message out to Vanguard News Network, a group and a forum that has been sort of isolated, I think, from a lot of the activism that's been going on. Our rallies in Toledo, our rallies in Lansing, and we've rallied in Orlando, and we've held smaller demonstrations across the country. And we've been bringing white activists of all stripes together to really build a movement where before we haven't had a movement, we've just had a few very inactive groups and a lot of Internet activity. And I think that that's something that your listeners in particular can be drawn to, and the VNN forum participants can be drawn to, because we are taking things out of the world of Internet forums and Internet activity and talking to actually bring action out to the streets.
Well, I've been really racially active for about 2 years, and before then it was kind of a hit and miss thing for me. And in that period of time, I must confess, your organization, or the NSM organization, is the only visible sign of activism I've seen, other than just sort of spreading the ideology.
Well, if you've been active for about 2 years, then you would have missed the last real wave of activism, which was centered around the National Alliance back in 2001, 2002, when Billy Roper, who's now marginalized himself out in white revolution, was bringing National Alliance members out into the streets and building the kind of alliances between organizations that was necessary for effective street action. Since that time, of course, William Pierce died. His group fell apart into infighting. The Vanguard News Network was, in fact, it was founded within the context of National Alliance, but it broke one of the first sort of public organs to break away from it. And as certain people fought each other for control of the National Alliance, more and more of them broke away until we have now a lot of organizations that are very fractured, still very focused on infighting. For instance, Billy Roper's group went out and banned most white activists from participating in its activities. You have people like Kevin Strom who are, you know, in National Vanguard, but not really doing a whole lot with National Vanguard except trying to flip their membership dues. And you have a lot of the smaller organizations that are always been in the white nationalist orbit, but they've never really been able to go beyond that one guy and his group of friends, sort of locally active, and build a national organization. And that's something the National Socialist Movement has out there. One of the reasons we draw so much attention is that we have a national organization. We have dozens and dozens of units all across the country constantly doing something. It doesn't matter if it's five guys passing out flyers in the middle of the mountains in Virginia, you know, or a guy running for office out in Montana, you know, or us demonstrating in the streets of Lansing. There's constantly something we're doing to bring our message to the white working class people that we are focused on helping.
Well, let me focus in on this, because there does seem to be something different about the NSM than all the other groups you've mentioned. And what I would like to ask you is, how important is hierarchy and rank within the NSM? And in other words, explain how discipline is maintained in the organization. Is there an attempt to standardize discipline across units, and is this successful?
Well, yes. We've actually been attacked by Jewish groups saying we're paramilitary and so forth, which is not true. But we are an organization that is very organized, and we have different people, and they fulfill different functions. And in fact, one of the reasons people join us, and one of the things that they really told us when they joined us, is we're not one guy who is, you know, the imperial grand poobah of whatever it is, or, you know, this is the president or whatever he wants to call himself. It's not one guy giving orders to everybody. It's a group of very talented, specialized leaders with our commander, Jeff Scoop, holding it all together and really being the glue that holds us together. But it's a group of very talented people, each of whom has their own sphere of activity, and each of whom at the national level directs one facet of the organization. And then at the we have regional leaders who help coordinate the states within their region. We have our state leaders. And within our state leaders, we have our unit leaders who are generally responsible for a portion of a state or a city. For instance, here in Virginia, the structure goes from Jeff Scoop to Wild Bill Hoff, who's our southeastern regional leader, to Taylor Bowles, who's the Virginia state leader. And then we have Virginia carved up into regions, and I'm in charge out here in southwest Virginia. We have Ken Krause in northern Virginia. We've got Kathy. Oh, and I forgot Kathy's last name. I'm going to have to apologize to her. But running southeast Virginia and the Norfolk area. And we have leaders in Richmond. And then we have, within those regions, we also have activists who are in charge of their town or their city. So, I mean, the National Socialist Movement is, we have enough people, is one of the other differences, where we can have somebody who's in charge of organizing a city and or a region of a state, and underneath them have people who, you know, are working on this town or that town and who are coordinating activities there. So the National Socialist Movement has, we have a structure that helps us manage and keep active the large number of people involved in our organization.
Is there, you know, the thing is, there's always, in my experience with organizations, there's always a sort of centrifugal force, and you know, to throw organizations apart. And I think that exists pretty much within all organizations, whatever they are. You know, Protestant Christianity, for instance, is a prime example of that. And but does this borrowing the outward appearance of the National Socialist Movement in Germany, are you borrowing organizational principles of the National Socialists in Germany to hold the organization together and give a discipline?
It's not really a borrowing. I mean, those are our principles. Do we use the same principles? Our members, in fact, one of our founders, Robert Brennan, had been involved in the 30s with the NSDAP in America or supporting the actual German National Socialists here in America. Our Colonel Hoff, who I just mentioned, his activism goes back to the German-American Bund. We utilize National Socialist techniques, organizational techniques, and we are modeled on the National Socialist movement that took control in Germany. Now, of course, we do what we need to do here in the United States, and we adapt to the situations here. We aren't rigidly defined by that, but we do emulate the tactics that were used there, and particularly by going out in the street, by making sure our voice is heard, by being at them, by not hiding, by not trying to pretend we're something else that we're not, or trying to conceal our views or try to make our views appeal to the main, what the mainstream Jewish press defines as a norm. We are out there to say what we have to say, and if other folk don't like it, they need to stand out of the way, because we are here to take control and put this country back on track. So, we have that same determination.
Bill, these rallies, this has been a quite stunning feature for me and other people to witness. And I visited NSM88.com, and I've seen that these rallies are you've been the organization. When I say you, I refer to the NSM, the organization. They've been doing these rallies for quite a long time. And can you tell us, as white activists, what the MSN has learned about how to manage these public events? Because I'm sure you all have learned from experience what works and what doesn't work. Because the NSM in Lansing was, I think, a terrific success, Bill. I think you did a great job.
I think it was, if you look objectively at what we gained by it. We had 200 emails from people inquiring about membership within 24 hours of the demonstration. We have had people joining up in record rates. And when we were walking around Michigan after the Lansing demonstration, people were coming up to us, shaking our hands, thanking us for demonstrating. The public reaction was overwhelming, but there was a lot of planning that went into it. And this is another area where we perform, I think, and some other groups don't. We go in there. We don't pick cities at random. We don't, come in from all over the country. But we pick areas where we have a local unit that is growing, like Michigan, where we've got, really, within 2 hours of Lansing, we've got three local units that have been growing.
Mm-hmm.
And we focus on those areas. We have people on the ground who can organize these things, and we've got people such as myself who went in there a week early to help handle the press and draw publicity and build the event in there. What we've learned is that the police and the authorities will do anything they can to shut you down. And that's really our biggest organizational challenge. In Lansing, we had a 3-hour, 70-mile gauntlet of checkpoints we had to hit in order to get into the demonstration. And if you didn't hit those, you were standing on the other side of the fence. And they make it very difficult. And one of the things we've focused on is how we can overcome this and hold demonstrations that will allow us to demonstrate without these excessive police restrictions. But what we've learned is that these demonstrations and these rallies are very effective almost regardless of their size or how they, even if the police, like in Lansing, lock out half the people who've come to attend or stick them on the wrong side of the fence, or like poor Tom Metzger got stuck in the opposition area, because he didn't want to risk the mobs that were trying to fight at the supporter section. Regardless of that, they're very effective in building our movement. And, yes, we have a lot. We've been doing them for a while. Our experience with them has been growing. And as our experience grows, we are more and more effective not only at getting people into the demonstrations, but at conducting them and conducting the whole run-up and the publicity and all the other things that go into making these demonstrations a success.
Well, let's ask about this publicity for a minute. Now, we live in a world that is defined by the Jewish media. And do you see any change over these past years or so since these rallies began and Lansing, and how the Jewish media has treated the NSM?
Well, it's really a question of getting around the biases of the Jewish media, and we've been more and more successful with that the more and more we've dealt with them. For instance, in Lansing, 2 days before the demonstration, there was a front page article in the Lansing State Journal, and its headline was, Rally Will Highlight Failure of Democracy for Whites. And that was the headline, front page of the Lansing State Journal. And that headline right there said just a huge amount. It was almost like we were shocked to see it burst through, because those kind of messages are not what the Jews want out there. They don't want to people to see that their democratic system is failing. They don't want people to see that their capitalist system is failing, that their system of economic and political exploitation is failing. But we got that out there by effectively handling the people who were covering us. And the Lansing State Journal was a very hostile newspaper. The Lansing State Journal went out of its way to insult us, and its editorials call us ignoramuses, and, you know, saying we were coming in here and we had no business being there. I mean, it was a real series of attack articles. It wasn't even really the professional level of journalism, just sort of crude insults. But we broke through that. And by managing that, and by having a strategy both to manage that and to manage the hype that public officials who had been denouncing us for a month and a half before the demonstration, by having a strategy to manage that as well, that we were able to really effectively communicate our message. And I think we communicated it probably more effectively than the demonstrations we've had in the past, with the exception of maybe Toledo, where the other side have communicated it for us. So, yeah, we've also been growing in terms of our ability to penetrate this sort of Jewish media silence.
What I got out of the NSM rally in Lansing was, and I think it stunned some people in the audience to some degree, of course I wasn't there, was that, hey, we are the NSM, we are not pro-war, we are not pro-capitalist, we're not pro-big business, and there seemed to be a stressing of some sort of social and social welfare side of what the NSM could be for whites. That is a program of mutual aid and assistance. Is that part of the message of the NSM too?
That is a fundamental part of the message, and it's a very effective part of the message. And we aren't out here playing into a stereotype of the right-wing reactionary. We aren't out here, we're not preaching to people, we're not out here telling them how great capitalism and free trade is. I mean, we're not playing up to the Republican conservative audience. And one of the things we get is there are a lot of people, particularly white young people from universities mostly, who come out and think they oppose us, and they come out and they hear us speak, and they realize, you know, I'm not really in opposition to these guys. And we get letters from these people who get organized to come out here and oppose us that say, you know, I came out there and I was standing in the opposition section, and I was listening to what you were saying about Iraq and Iran and about the economy and about internationalization of the economy and how it's affecting people, and I realized that I really agree with about 90% of what you have to say. And that, you know, these people think they're very effective by bringing out, you know, 200 or so people in opposition, but they don't realize that some of those people who are coming out there thinking they're in opposition are coming over to our side of the fence, because they realize that we are not this sort of stereotype that these leftists and these anarchists and these communists create. You know, we realize the war in Iraq is a Jewish war. We realize that the global economic system is a system that exploits and abuses white working class people. We realize that there is this sort of injustice going on, and we are struggling against that, just as we're struggling against racial injustices, these sort of ethnic, religious, whatever you want to call the Jewish tyranny type of injustices. We are struggling on a broad platform. We are not a one issue, just discussing race or just discussing race in crude sort of reactionary terms. We are a nationalist, but also socialist movement.
Let me ask you something else. I visited your site, Overthrow, overthrow.com, and you have a newsletter there called the Libertarian, was it Libertarian Socialist?
Libertarian Socialist News, yep.
Could you tell me what you mean by, our listeners, what you mean by Libertarian Socialist?
Well, that's a name that got stuck a long time ago, and I'm not sure if it still accurately describes things. When I was younger, I used to be very left-wing. used to be very left-wing and a bit of an anarchist. And I moved from that leftist paradigm into a national socialist paradigm, in particular because I became educated first about Jewish issues and then about race issues. And libertarian socialist is a classic name for anarchist. It's something we sort of revived maybe 6-7 years ago when I changed the name of my some of the stuff on my website. And it's just something we haven't updated since
well,
then. But
I was thinking about that. You know, if we have a homogenous community of whites who are, you know, bound together in some ways, you know, I don't see why we couldn't have, a sort of a libertarian streak running in our socialism. You know, I think it's kind of an interesting blending. You know, the Nazis obviously blended nationalism and socialism, which before then had been, socialism had been internationalism.
Well, I'm not certain of that. And let me tell you two things there.
Please.
Socialism was not internationalism until it was taken over by the Marxists and the Jews. Socialism was also not an authoritarian centralized state until it was taken over by the Marxists and the Jews. And early German socialism and Volkisch socialism was very focused on the ethnic character of the German people and their ancestry and their history and their ancient religion and so forth. I mean, it was very focused on that. And the Jewish Marxists came in and said, no, we're going to impose our view of socialism as the only socialism, and we're going to beat up with clubs anybody who comes out in the street to disagree with us. And in terms of liberty and socialism, in a white community, in a community of people who are capable of exercising civil liberties and civil rights, National Socialism has never abridged people's fundamental rights. National Socialist system in Germany never abridged white people's fundamental rights. Adolf Hitler expanded gun ownership. He really expanded the right of free speech by suppressing the communists who had been stopping it. And if you look at the context of Germany and the emergency situation that Germany was in, you had communists taking up arms and seizing local parliaments, seizing local governments, overthrowing and at times driving away the local police and army. And these communists were a real danger, because there was a real danger the Soviets would assist them, and the Soviets were already providing money, but physically assist them, militarily assist them, and come in and seize control of Germany and make it an appendage of the Bolshevik state. And he enacted emergency measures in that context. But these communists, just like today, where communists are a threat to our fundamental, white people's fundamental liberties. Because the communists, you could come out to the streets and say what you have to say, the communists will attack you with a club. They'll say that you've got no free speech for hate speech, which is hate speech being any speech they disagree with. Right? The danger to civil liberties is letting these armed mobs assault people. And we need a state that will stop them. And one of the things we point out at these demonstrations, when these communists start rioting and assaulting people, is that here are the police absolutely incapable of stopping these rioters, or really absolutely lacking the political will. Whether it's Jack Ford, mayor of Toledo, shaking hands with a 15-year-old kid and trying to negotiate an end to them burning buildings, or these police in Lansing who stood by and allowed communist mobs to attack and tear down fences and try to assault people who are out there to support us. The police and the government have failed white working people. They cannot protect white working people. And the only organization that can is the National Socialist Movement.
Yes. You know, I don't understand, you know, of course, you know, I'm racially conscious and an activist and at some level. And this idea of fearing the NSM itself, versus fearing the system that's destroying us and impoverishing us and is exposing us to all this crime and mayhem, and it just doesn't make sense to me. And that's exactly what you just said. I don't see, other than, you know, rallying around an organization with, you know, with social and economic points such as the NSM, I don't see how we can survive.
I agree with you. In terms of the white movement and the people who oppose us within the white nationalist movement, you have to understand, for the past 25 years, really, from the early 70s through the early 2000s. The white movement has been dominated by people who have been really engaged in the economic exploitation of white activists. And what I mean is by setting up organizations where they collect dues and then go out and either pocket the dues for their own personal benefit, or they go out and they gamble them away, or they use them on drugs, or they use them for strippers and whores and drinking parties. We have seen organization after organization in this mold. And one of the other prominent organizations out there today is led by people in this mold. And these people fear the National Socialist Movement, I think, more than anybody else does, because we come in and we say we're not going to just pocket people's money and run this sort of exploitative but do-nothing pseudo-activism. We're going to go out there in the streets and we're going to take charge. And these people see that their livelihoods and their way of supporting themselves is being threatened, and we know them. Some of our guys have been around 30 years when these guys are just getting started, and we know how they are, and they know we're not going to cut them in, and we're not going to allow them to hold a leadership position so they can continue to exploit the living out of people. And there, if you want to see fear of National Socialism, that's where that comes from.
Are you familiar with David Irving's biography of Joseph Goebbels?
I've got a copy that David Irving signed.
Well, that's an amazing thing, and I would recommend that everyone read that book, because I think he was really quite the architect of the Third Reich. David Irving called him the mastermind of the Third Reich, and the struggles he went into Berlin to establish the National Socialists in Berlin, and the infighting within white nationalists, and of course the terror of the Jewish chief of police within Berlin towards Goebbels. It reminded me a little bit of what you've described tonight with the NSM. Let me kind of throw a curveball at you here. And it's kind of a political question in a way. I've read some comments by some other blogs, people who are right wingers. They're conservatives. They may be racially aware at some level, but they kind of touch it tenderly, and they have suggested in response to the NSM that all these post-World War II National Socialist organizations are in fact now. I'm not trying to insult you here, but here's what they're saying. I don't really agree with them. They're saying that they're all controlled by British, German, or American intelligence agencies. And I'll ask you directly, is the NSM under the control of intelligence agencies, or is the NSM a false flag operation?
When people say that, I just respond, of course we're all gay welfare Jews. I mean, if you read the opposition press, the truth of it.
Right.
Who cares what those people have to say? No, obviously the National Socialist Movement is not under control of the Queen or the corporate conspiracy that, to incorporate the U.S. and turn people into straw men and all this other ridiculous nonsense that people are. We don't even deal with things on that level. That's part of what is really called the Patriot or Constitutional Movement. People don't like to explain the real world. I mean, the real world is a very harsh place. And it's not, Jews are evil. I mean, that's true. And we have a system that exploits people. That's true. And we have people in power who created societies and so forth and been involved in various things and conspired at times. And that can be demonstrated. But the crazy things that people say are just make-believe, the belief that the Mossad runs everything. There is a Mossad in the Zionist entity. It is a bad group of people. One of our activists recently returned from Palestine and saw Mossad agents murder a man in the street. I mean, it's just as a matter of course. That's just something they do regularly. And the Mossad is vicious, and it assassinates people. But it's not responsible for all of our country's woes. All right, the CIA is there, and the CIA does do things like cause divisions among white activists, all right, and do things like run programs to to neutralize political movements. Yes, there is a CIA, but the CIA doesn't run everything. All right, and British intelligence in particular, this theory that the Queen has incorporated the U.S. and bought it and sold everybody into debt. You know, the U.S. has a debt, and the U.S. debt does represent a mortgaging of the labor of working people in the United States, but it does not represent a literal legal mortgaging, like you can go and file some crazy court papers and reclaim it type of thing. And these ideas about British intelligence in particular come out of these people who have invented these weird theories. And it goes back to these people who I was talking about who exploit the gullibility of some segments of the white movement. It's a lot easier to believe sometimes in these crazy conspiracy theories than it is to believe in what's really happening out there. Because what's really happening out there requires you to go out and do something that you may not be comfortable doing. It requires you to go out in the street and be active in the streets. It requires you to go out in the real world and confront real people who really want to harm you. And that's what we do when we hold these demonstrations. It requires you to be active, and to do hard work, to go out there and distribute flyers and to speak to people and shake their hands and discuss National Socialism. It's hard. And these people come along with these theories, you know, that are easy. The reason I'm not involved in this is because it's an intelligence front. Well, how the hell do they know what an intelligence front is? You know, most of them have never had any experience, real experience, with the government at all. So what do they know about it? Well, they just make it up as an excuse not to go out in the streets and actually struggle for something. Because everything's run by the government, there's no point in struggling. They make up these theories that you can go into court and read some magic formula and win, instead of having to go out and do what's hard, which is hire an attorney and actually not have broken the law, you know, and go out there and win your case. You know, people who do that, they're playing on the weakness and gullibility of other people. They're something the National Socialist Movement is very strongly opposed to. And we, you know, have been driving these charlatans out by showing the people, the real people, the vast majority who is connected to the real world, that real struggle on real issues can affect real results.
Well, I've seen, you know, from looking in the outside, it looks to me like the NSM is a struggling, fighting, and I mean by struggling, I don't mean weak. I mean struggling as in hard working, and they're really trying to do something and move forward, it looks like a very sincere effort on my part, and that's part of the reason why you're here today, because I'm very much impressed with that. Let's ask a bigger question. The SA in Germany, and I know we're talking about the United States here, and I know the NSM is dealing with the circumstances here today, but the SA in many ways was a revolutionary organization. They really wanted to change German society, and readers can find out the specifics of that. Is the NSM a revolutionary organization?
So the National Socialist Movement is a revolutionary organization modeled on the peaceful political revolution that was achieved by Adolf Hitler and the original National Socialist German Workers' Party. Not just in being revolutionary and in tactics, but in intent and in how we want to remake society. We want to undo the evil that has been done by the Jewish capitalist system for the past century. We want to roll time back, and we want to put people on the right track, which they were tricked into abandoning in 1945, or really 1939, when they declared war on the German National Socialist State.
Bill, do you consider, you've had a long history, and I believe you've run for office in some sort of local level, state levels, I was reading on your website. Are you a politician, Bill? Do you consider yourself a politician?
I consider myself politically active. I think politician carries a lot of negative connotations with it. I've certainly been involved in election campaigns. I've run some third-party campaigns, and I run some very effective third-party campaigns. The National Socialist Movement is a political movement. We are a movement that is striving to get political power, and we will be running candidates across the country in 2008. But I wouldn't consider us politicians in the sense that we are not the sort of lesser men of the Democrat state, the people who spend their time worrying about what will happen in the next 5 minutes. but they don't look at the larger picture of what they're doing to society. They worry about, you know, how my vote on immigration will affect me at the next election a year from now. But they don't worry about how it will affect the country 20 years from now. They worry about how their vote on a war will go down with their constituents tomorrow. But they don't worry about how it will reflect on their principles long after they're gone. You know, these petty politicians of the bourgeois democratic state is not what the petty politics of the bourgeois democratic state is not what the National Socialist Movement represents. We represent a new kind of politics, a united white nationalist and socialist politics.
Bill, I think if, you know, looking forward at the NSM, you know, I think I'm certainly hoping that it matures and ripens and becomes a real force. But I think looking at politics as they exist in the United States today, and if they aren't altered dramatically by some sort of cataclysmic event, I think you're going to run up into a wall. And, you know, a sincere leftist, a person I'm not exactly thrilled about, but I think he's sincere in his belief, that was Ralph Nader. And he said, you know, very repeatedly when he's run for president, that we're dealing with a system that is rigged, and that a third party and cannot win, it cannot advance.
That's not correct. Really, okay. What Ralph Nader's problem and what a lot of parties' problems are is they focus on high office and they don't focus on low. And okay. Your focus in a political movement has to be locally in the United States. A third party can certainly win. Particularly in a situation where the main parties are increasingly alienated from the general population. But it has to win on the backs of its local candidates. And while it may be important to have a larger sort of overarching national campaign, but you have to build your local political institutions first, and you really have to build your local economic, political, and cultural institutions first. Meaning that, you know, Ralph Nader runs for president, which is fine, he can run for president, but he's not going to win the presidency. Because how many green congressmen are there? How many green governors are there? Not even at that level. How many green mayors are there? How many Green Party state delegates are there? I mean, there aren't a lot. There are a few, but there aren't many. And you can't just will a political organization into existence overnight. You have to struggle. And if there's a wall that says that people who hold our views can never achieve political power, can never achieve political office, then why waste time struggling? Why not just, you know, relapse into these conspiracy theories? Why not say everything's impossible? Why not just sit there at home and let it happen, because you're going to lose anyway? And if you believe that you can't win, then why are you wasting your time fighting? But if you believe you can win, then you're the kind of person that we want in the National Socialist Movement.
Where do you see the heart? Or do you see a pattern in who is joining the NSM? Is this a white working class phenomenon? Is this a Midwestern phenomenon? Or is there any type of person that really seems to be the demographic that is joining the NSM?
White people across the board. I mean, from 20 to 60. You know, we focus on the issues of the white working class because the white working class is the majority of white people in this country. But we are all over the United States. We have units organized in almost every state in the union. In fact, more than just the ones that are on our website. I was trying to make a count the other day, and we are everywhere. And we are white people united everywhere. It doesn't matter. I mean, I own property for a living. I invest in real estate, you know, but I go out there and work and so forth as well on all my properties. But, you know, wealth-wise, I would have grown outside of what would be considered working class. But I'm involved in the National Socialist Movement. And so are guys like, we had in Lansing, one of the state newspapers, the Michigan State News, did a profile on our members, and we had Dan Hill, who's a machinist, you know, Dan Carlson. I have to go look up what Dan does, the other Dan does, but, and we had me up there as well. You know, we represent a broad sort of cross-section of the white population, because white people everywhere are tired of the government and what it's doing to them and how it's hurting them economically and culturally psychologically, politically. I mean, there's an attack on white people across the board. And we are a response of white people who, from all different walks of life, who have been victims of that attack.
You know, one of the things that really became clear listening, and I mentioned this earlier, Bill, was that, and this is part of the miseducation of public as far as history goes, and I understood this about the National Socialists in Germany, too, but if you listen to the rally in Lansing, the NSM, if I may say so, Bill, are not part of this right-left hoax, they've really got some very good ideas that are very appealing to people from the left as well as from the right. And, you know, as I was reading this, as I mentioned this Irving biography on Goebbels, do you know who Horst Wessel is?
Yes, I do.
Yes. Well, Horst Wessel, before Goebbels brought him over into National Socialism, was a member of was a communist.
Yep.
And I'm thinking that, and Horst Wessel was a fighter for the National Socialists, and he was a sincere fighter for National Socialists. And I'm really thinking when you go to those meetings, Bill, and the NSM. When I say you, I mean the NSM. When they go to those meetings, those rallies, and they speak, and they have a chance to deliver unfiltered the message of the NSM. I'm thinking that there's going to be a lot of lefties that are going to say, hey, these guys aren't my enemy. Are you finding
well, yes.
that to be true?
Well, yes, as I was saying, a lot of the folks who come out to oppose us find that they're more in agreement with us than they thought. The major points of disagreement are race and the Jews. However, on the conservative side of the fence, those are still the same major
yes.
points of disagreement, the race issues and the Jews. And, you know, we have... Today, and one of the things I discussed on my website today is we have people in Chicago who are Minutemen and who are Republican Party activists and Free Republic activists who are trying to organize against us with a race is not the issue campaign mm-hmm. to highlight their opposition to immigration, but race is not the issue. All right? And we have that there. And we have leftists who come out and say ridiculous things. And they had them protesting at a in Lansing with the National Socialist Movement supports the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative, which is a conservative effort to eliminate racism by eliminating affirmative action programs, et cetera. And we were asked about by the press, and we said, well, we certainly aren't opposed to racial preferences, and we certainly wouldn't put an initiative like this forward. So this idea that we are somehow a movement of the right wing is really ridiculous. The right wing is as opposed to us as the left wing, because right and left are Jewish control mechanisms. It's a false dichotomy. The Jew loves these false dichotomies, these appearances of opposition, when no real opposition exists. The Jew loves to have somebody out there screaming, somebody out there who's racially tolerant, multicultural and diverse, screaming at somebody else who's also racially tolerant, multicultural and diverse, and the two of them really believing they're in opposition. Because, therefore, all the angry people can be lined up on one side or the other, be told that the power structure represents the other side, and go out and fight and really believe they're struggling against the system, when all they're doing is struggling within the context of the system. And that's what we have in this country. We have conservatives who promote the Jews' agenda, who go out and struggle against liberals and leftists who also promote the Jews' agenda. And the only group out there that's not promoting the Jews' agenda is the National Socialist Movement. And so they both come together thinking that they oppose us because they've all been told that the right-wingers tell people that we're leftists and the left-wingers tell people we're right-wingers, and then their followers who don't know any better come out and hear, hey, we're not either one of those. We're something new and better.
On this subject of right-left for a minute, and because this you're someone who's thought about this, and other people that I've talked to have thought about this, actually, are not the right-wingers, the conservatives, the respectable conservatives, aren't they really more of an impediment to the greater cause of white nationalism than the left is?
Well, let me tell you this. There's certainly a greater distraction. There's a very large segment, or I say a competing segment, of the white nationalist movement who believes that the future of white nationalism must be tapped onto the coattails of the Republican Party. And they believe very sincerely that they need to be what we call racial conservatives, that they need to not attack the Jews, leave the Jews alone, because Jews are conservatives too. They can think like them and pretend they think like them as well. And they want to go and tap themselves on there and just go on race issues. And they want to talk about, oh, segregation and blacks and Mexicans and immigration, but they won't talk about the Jews. And that's where that path leads you, by saying I'm a conservative, by saying I want to be part of conservative politics, is you get appended onto this existing Jewish-controlled Republican and paleo-conservative Republican movement. And the National Socialist Movement isn't about that. We're about taking these conservatives who are standing in the way of white people and pushing them aside and taking control and saying, we are the white working class. We're not going to buy into this capitalist Jewish lie. We're not going to buy into this system of exploitation. We're not going to control what we're saying about the Jew because we want to curry favor with them. And we're going to stand up for white people, and we're going to struggle, and we're going to take control, and we're going to put things back the way they should be. And that is the difference between National Socialism and racial conservatism. Racial conservatism is a kind of accommodation to the system, whereas National Socialism is a revolutionary movement to change that system.
What do you think about, you know, BNN and other outlets? You know, we produce a lot of propaganda, and when I mean propaganda in the positive meaning, that, you know, we're out producing a lot of ideas and writing a lot of things to forward and advance ideas, you know, visual cartoons. But, you know, when you judge that against the effect of having 75 or whatever it was, 75 or 150 men and women on the courthouse steps in Lansing, that seems to be to dwarf anything that propaganda can do. Don't you think so?
Well, I don't know.
At least on our side.
Jeff, right. Are you aware of my history with Vanguard News Network? I mean, I used to work with Alex Linder to produce it.
Roughly I know about it.
Yes. Well, I'm sure you've heard one version of it. And, well, let me say this. My opinion of Vanguard News Network is this. There are some things that people involved in it are doing that are positively oriented. I think that distributing newspapers is important. I think there's a lot of people put a lot of energy into it. I think there's a lot of people put a lot of money into producing some of the newspapers you guys produce. I think that's good. But I think there's a real question of leadership and who is organizing, how things are being organized. And I think that the National Socialist Movement has a lot of very talented people, each of which is involved in some specialization, and all of whom are able to get along with each other and who are sort of socially normal and are trustworthy. And I think that you have to look at the leadership of other groups. When you're putting your energy and your money into doing something, you need to look at who is managing it and where they're taking it. Now, in terms of propaganda versus rallies, I have to say here, the rallies don't happen in a vacuum. And we're out there, we have our unit out there a month and a half beforehand, tacking up posters, handing out flyers, talking to people about National Socialism, signing up members. Then we have, in this case, I flew in there, or drove in there, actually, for Lansing, a week early and spent time dealing with the television and the newspapers and doing the stories and selling these people on stories to get them up there. And then we hold the rally itself, and then afterwards we continue to try to build media or build attention. So we continue with follow-up. And we are, it's not just the rally. It's the whole sort of frenzy we build up around it that creates the effect. And so when you're talking about distributing newspapers and literature and publishing on the Internet and having forums, that's important. It builds community and it introduces people to the cause. But it can't happen in a vacuum. You have to do it in the context of an organization that can have a rally at the end of it, and that has people who will come in and be active and show their faces in the context of a media strategy. I mean, putting out newspapers and then also having someone available to go on the TV stations and talk to them. And the newspapers are tied into an event that people can come out and attend. you know, an interesting event, one that's going to be front page of the newspaper. You know, there's a whole mesh of things that come together. And Vanguard News Network has always been very focused on the publishing end of things. And, you know, the publishing end of things is sort of where it begins, but the organizing part of it, publishing has to exist within the context. And, again, the other issue I would have with the VNN approach is the leadership under which the activities are occurring. You have to put your money on the right horse. And, you know, and that there are a number of white organizations where I would sort of question whether they're the right horse to put the money on.
Yeah, the original question really wasn't so much a comparison between VNN and NSM, but it was just, you know, this idea of getting people out there and speaking directly like this. I think it really just the value of that is so enormous. But what you brought out was when you see this rally, you're seeing just the tip of the iceberg. That's what you're saying.
Yep, that's the end of it. Again, the beginning of it is we have a person. Person starts a unit, gets some people recruited, builds up his unit to a few dozen people. Then they distribute literature, and then they plan a rally. And then we send people in from our national office, and we go out there and we talk to the newspapers, and we do the radio talk shows when they'll let us on. I found out I'm getting blacklisted from a lot of radio talk shows, but... we go out and we do that, and we do newspaper interviews, and we go on the TV, and we give press conferences. You know, and we're in the news, and in Toledo, we were on the news every day for 10 days. We were the lead story prior to our demonstration. In Lansing, we were the lead story every day for about 7 days, plus quite a bit before that, building up to it, before the demonstration. And so by the time we hold the demonstration, it doesn't even matter how many people actually show up. I mean, show up to watch it. I mean, we had, you know, we had probably about 100 of our guys show up in Lansing. We had 200 opponents, about 50 supporters, and we had about 250 people who were just there observing. But it was magnified. It was on 133 different news broadcasts across the country, CNN and Fox News headlines.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Well, it's the result of a lot of hard work. I mean, we build these events up very deliberately on a very deliberate strategy, and the publishing and the websites are all part of it. We generally get about a 10% share of the market on our website when we hold these rallies. In Orlando, we had 30,000 households come and read my website for coverage. In Lansing, it was about 10,000 households, which, given the differences in size between Orlando and Lansing, is about the right proportion. You know, we are able, we have that there, so people see us on the TV, and then they can come on the internet and get undiluted, accurate information, as opposed to some of what goes out on the TV, which can get into the ridiculous, and then have an action that they can take. They see the rally, they're impressed with the rally, now they can go on the website, they can learn more about it, and then they can join the NSM and build into the next rally. And again, that whole sort of, we're sort of like the whole package instead of just one part of the package. We are hitting every aspect we can.
The last question, I want to remind the listeners they can visit NSM88.com, which is the webpage for the National Socialist Movement, or they can visit Overthrow.com, which is more of your own private website, is it not, Bill?
Yes, as my website, we do cover the National Socialist Movement quite a bit. But it's not an official NSM website.
Okay. Now, I have to ask this because, you know, what generates a lot of controversy on the forum, and I guess I should say unfortunately, is, you know, considering, you know, the other issues at stake here and the serious things of what we talked about today in this program, like the impoverishment of the country and economics you know, all these other political ideas. What generates the most controversy on the forum is this uniform business. Now, if I don't bring this up, people are going to say, "Why didn't you bring this up?" So let me say here it kind of goes in two parties, two camps. Okay, many say, "Well, yeah, I would join the NSM, but for the uniform." The uniform, oh no, I can't do that. And the other side says, "Okay, the uniform's a good idea, but it should be modified in some way so it doesn't look like the uniform of the 1930s National Socialist Germany. So
let me tell you this. First of all, not every member of the National Socialist Movement wears a uniform. There are plenty of people who join who do not. If you look at our demonstrations, there are plenty of people standing there who are not wearing our uniform but who are members. So anybody who's saying, I would join but I don't want to wear a uniform is full of it. They're looking for an excuse not to join. Okay. As opposed to talking about the uniform issue in general, you got to look at the history of the National Socialist White People's Party and the various splinters that occurred in the early 70s, particularly David Duke, who was a National Socialist White People's Party youth organizer, along with Don Black, but who splintered off and was, in fact, financed by Willis Cardo in splintering off. And what had happened here is Willis Cardo had first basically backed William Pierce, and William Pierce had double-crossed Cardo, and Cardo was looking for a new horse to back, and he got on the David Duke horse. And they together came up with this, we're not going to be the National Socialist Movement, we're going to be the Ku Klux Klan. And they took over the name Ku Klux Klan. They did that to 1980. And about late 1979, early 1980, David Duke was mired in scandals for stealing from his Klan. And he gave a speech where he coined the term Hollywood Nazi. Right? And this is where this thing comes from. It doesn't come from anybody who has any sort of principled objection to the National Socialist Movement. It comes from opportunists who broke off the National Socialist White People's Party, felt that to make their own organization, they needed to define themselves differently, and who made up this attack, first on the NSWPP and the Nazi groups, and then on the Klan, which David Duke helped found, and he called it Hollywood Nazism, said it would never succeed, and said he was going to succeed by donning a suit and tie and going out there and joining the business world. And then he changed the name of his group to the NAAWP. And what David Duke did was spent the next 20 years, stole more than $3 million from his supporters, according to just from what the FBI found, and that was just in the 90s, stole $3 million of movement money, used it on cocaine, on strippers, and on gambling. And, I mean, devastated the movement, held it back, took what was, you know, it used to be a National Socialist demonstration would bring out hundreds, if not thousands of people. In Chicago, in particular, the Marquette Park demonstrations, or just marching through Cincinnati, Ohio, there were 300 men who just showed up and did that. I mean, there used to be hundreds who show up, and National Socialist candidates were winning 10, 12, 15% of the vote. It was a very effective move. And a few men, for their own personal advantage and their own momentary libertine pleasure, took this organization and made up this uniform issue in order to break the white movement and bend it towards their will. So when I hear people saying that we should not wear uniforms and this is Hollywood Nazism and the rest, I think about the corruption and the falsity that's behind that accusation, where it comes from, and I ignore it. If you don't want to wear a uniform, fine. You stay on the Internet and you stay away from our demonstrations because we don't need people who cannot see the benefit of what we're doing. You know, the National Socialist Movement, we are effective. The uniform says so much, just by showing up and having these people take a photo of us, we can say we say more than they'll ever quote us as saying in print. And that is, if nothing else, the pragmatic benefit of the uniforms.
Well, you know, also people can refer to what George Lincoln Rockwell wrote about the swastika itself, which is a very interesting subject in itself. But I'm afraid we don't have time to talk about it. You know, now that we have a few more minutes left, that was supposed to be the last question about the uniforms, and I think you've spoken very clearly about it. What about Tom Metzger's approach? He's a very interesting fellow, and I follow him, and he did comment on your blog about this, and readers can view his comments. But basically, he's still saying the lone wolf is the way to go. How would you critique his argument about the lone wolf?
Let me preface this by saying I like Tom Metzger. I've met him. I've only met him face-to-face on one occasion. I've traded a lot of emails with him. He's a good guy. He's heading in the right direction. But I'll tell you, I don't want to spend the rest of my life paying $800 a month to the Southern Poverty Law Center because some kid took what I'm saying and went out and killed somebody. And if you want to go out and espouse lone wolfism and not do lone wolfism, but just sit there and encourage other people to do it, at some point in time in your life, you're going to be paying half of everything you bring in to the Southern Poverty Law Center, because if somebody's going to go out, we're going to act on it, and you're the one who's going to get taken down for it. The National Socialist Movement is a legal political movement. You know, we are not in a position to launch some sort of armed insurrection against the government. And in fact, Adolf Hitler, in coming to power, when he came to power, always made a point to say that this was the first peaceful socialist revolution to take control of a government in the Western world. I mean, in fact, if you look at the history of Jewish socialism and Jewish internationalism and this violent, hateful, destructive so-called socialism, everywhere you see massacres and billions of people, or millions and millions of people killed, whether it's Pol Pot or Mao Zedong or Joseph Stalin and Vladimir Lenin. But the National Socialist Revolution was peaceful. It didn't go out and massacre people. It didn't go out and massacre its own people. It took control democratically. And the National Socialist Movement of today is based upon that peaceful political movement that took control democratically in social and cultural conditions very similar to what's developing here in the United States today.
But, Bill, let me follow up with that. And I know our time is limited because you've got to go to your show. But I have a slight – I don't think you're saying exactly what I'm going to say, but I cannot see how the people, the parasites that own our media, the parasites that are in charge of our businesses, the parasites that command our military – and et cetera, these very powerful forces, I cannot see how they're going to be done. What's the right verb to use? Done away with. I don't see how their power is going to be taken away from them by any without the application of violence in some fashion. Do you really think that the NSM is going to convince a large enough percentage of the country that these people will just leave?
Well, I don't think we need to convince. I think people are already convinced. We just need to organize and mobilize. If you want to see violence, every time we have a demonstration, you see the violence of the state and these sort of militant vanguard of the state, these communists and these anarchist kids come out and attack people. All right, and the police do everything they can to disrupt us. And this happens. But it hasn't stopped us. We've continued to grow. And if you really believe that the people in this country are unbeatable, undefeatable, that nobody can ever struggle against them, well, then why struggle at all? Why not just go along with their system? I mean, that if they can't be beaten, are they that really that powerful? See, I don't believe these people are undefeatable. I don't believe they're that powerful. I mean, people have money, and people have weapons, and they have countries. But each of these countries was founded in some way by somebody who overthrew or disposed of a powerful system that came before it. And when we have a country like the United States, where the leadership is driving the country into a hole, I mean, the United States is going bankrupt. And we haven't, the price of gold, which is one of the best indications of inflation, the price of gold has doubled in the last 2 years, which is also a good indication of currency stability. The price of gasoline, it's not just going up because of the war. There's a real inflation driving it. And if you look at the debt of the United States, we've added something like $2 trillion in debt since Bush took office, and we're adding $100 billion a month because of this war in Iraq. This country is being hollowed out financially, and at some point the government's going to go bankrupt, just like the government of Puerto Rico went bankrupt a few weeks ago and put out hundreds of thousands of people were put out of work and were in the streets because they'd lost their jobs. All right, this country is going bankrupt. We've hollowed out our economy. We've hollowed out our productive economy. We've taken our jobs away. You know, our rush to lower prices with things like Walmart and importing goods from third world countries has undermined our wages and driven them down further than it's driven down the price of goods. And with inflation raising those prices of goods and wages still falling, and in fact, I was looking the other day, the price of goods is up 15-20% in over, I have to go check the time period, it was in the last year or two, and the price the wages had dropped 10-12% in most working class industries at least, on that same period. And with falling wages and rising prices, you're eventually going to drive people by the multitude into the streets, because people are going to begin to not be able to afford the things they need to live. And that kind of economic crisis hollowed out Weimar Germany, combined with the military crisis, and they had the defeat in World War One. We are being defeated and running our military into the ground in Iraq, and even without our soldiers being massacred, our equipment is being destroyed and worn out. We're not able to replace it. We didn't even have enough National Guard helicopters to shore up the levees in New Orleans and stop the flooding there during Katrina. You know, with this country's power is being hollowed out, and when this elite finishes failing and finishes destroying themselves, the National Socialist movement will be there to take their place.
I sure hope so. I sure hope it works out like that, Bill. And you've got my best wishes. Well, I wanted to thank you for coming on, and I hope that I can invite other members from the NSM on too. And you know, we'll all be watching. And I know there's a lot of people. I've had a lot of conversations with various people, and people who are reluctant. Do a lot right at the moment, but it really opened their eyes what happened in Lansing and Toledo, and they see that you guys are focused and on target, and good things can happen.
Yes, they can. I encourage all your listeners out there, go to NSM88.com, fill out the membership form, join your local National Socialist Movement unit, and get active in our struggle.
All right. Thank you very much, Bill.
Thanks.
The Truth Is No Defense is a production of Vanguard News Network Broadcasting.